speaker for this evening, Rick H. from San Diego.
My name is Rick. I'm an alcoholic. It's great to be here. Thanks, Lori, for asking me to speak. She told me I had to dress up a little bit. So I'm wearing this uniform of the upgraded AA Society of Total Serenity and Purity, of which I am the only member. Congratulations to Mark and Larry. Larry is a paragon of AA service. He does all sorts of things for people. He's been here forever. See him all over town. Congratulations, Larry. And it's nice to be here. It's good to be in an AA meeting anytime, anywhere. It's great to be sober. My sobriety date is December 5th, 1977. So if I stay sober another 5 days, I'll have 41 years and 6 months, right? Get me a 6-month token for that. Right? And if you're like me, you know, if you're young here now, or you're thinking, this is an old guy, he doesn't know anything about being young in sobriety or being a young drunk. But if you do the math, anybody that's got 41 years sober couldn't have got here when he was 50 years old, okay? I mean, if you're an older person in AA, if you've been around a while, that means you were a young person in AA, and that was me. I got here when I was not quite 25. I felt like I was about 90. The good people were all dead. The good times were all gone. There I was, you know, adrift in a horrible world of disco and whatnot. You know. 1977, Elvis had just died. You know, it was all over. You know, the apocalypse had come. And the thing was, I mean, you hear these stories about these old guys saying, I spilled more than you drank. And I never heard that, you know. When I came in, they did sort of say or look at me and it's like, oh my God, what's AA coming to, you know. The way I looked, everybody, you know, sort of welcomed me, even if they didn't like my look so much, because they could see that I was just about done, you know, I was about off this world. I was, you know. I started young. First time I got drunk, I was 14, and that was the first time I went to jail, too. I went to jail of my first drunk. I had, you know, smoked a little dope before, but first time I got good and drunk, I got good and put in jail. And it kind of went like that for me. I started young, and I think Jeremiah, great job, by the way, nailed it. But that thing about I made a commitment that this was the way I was going to go. You know, I didn't ease into it. I didn't have any social drinking time. I started right in. I mean, the weekend after... a few days, actually, after I was put in jail, I was drinking behind the market with some friends who'd stolen some booze from there. And I had stolen the booze that I got drunk on the week before. And it sort of went like that. I committed myself. You know, I was into it. That was all I wanted to do. You know, I was playing a little music. You know, that was sort of my occupation, I guess. But really what I was a alcoholic, a partier, a drunk. I heard the word alcoholic. I didn't really understand what that meant. It took me a while to understand what alcoholic meant. I thought it meant you like to drink a lot. Yeah, I'm an alcoholic. Yeah, I like to party. That wasn't it, you know. But I didn't know that I was an alcoholic, a real alcoholic, for a while because I didn't want to stop drinking. You know, you have to really want to stop drinking to understand that you're an alcoholic. You have to get to that place. Not only do you want to stop drinking, but you know that you can't stop drinking. That's the first step. You know, but I thought it was, I like to party. Later on, you know, I went along. I had a good time at first, you know, or certainly an interesting time. You know, I just went for it all the way. There was no more of that school stuff. The only time I went to school after, I don't know, ninth grade or so was to sell drugs on campus, right? There was more drug buyers per square, you know, foot there than anywhere else. So I went, and I figured out, too, I'd gone, actually 10th grade I went and was sort of being the normal bad guy, you know, not going to class and all that, and drinking all the time and, you know, being conspicuous. But I figured out in 11th grade what you want to do is you want to kind of go under the radar there. So I went to school every day and sold drugs. But I took the classes like, you know, remedial math, you know, that doing what stuff I'd done in the fourth grade or fifth grade. And, you know, modern science, you know, where you didn't do any chemistry or biology. You sort of did the stuff that I'd done in the sixth grade. I'd been a good student up till about the sixth grade, right? So I was good for those classes. And I didn't, you know, I didn't make waves. I got decent grades without, and I sold drugs. And but that was really too constrictive, too. And by the 12th grade, I was gone out of there. I actually finished up my school career in continuation high school. I got my certificate from continuation. I had the opportunity about 25 years later, 22 years later, to go back. You remember that show, Welcome Back, Cotter? Okay, so I got to go back to my continuation high school as a teacher, right? And, you know, I was feeling pretty good about that. And I told the kids there and that I was an alumni of that school, and they said, no way, you know, because an old guy can't be, you know. That's sort of what I thought when I got to AA. Old guys don't understand, you know. But I had been there. Remember there was one guy there, they were a little tougher or something than we were when I was there. We were just all degenerate drug addicts, alcoholics, sort of in and out of reform school, you know. And there was one guy there, and he didn't show up for a few days, and I said, what happened to Jeremiah, or whatever his name was? And they said, Tuesday night, he was in a drive-by shooting. He's probably going to be in prison the rest of his life. And I thought, gee, if they do that on Tuesday night, what are they doing the weekends, you know? So, but in those days, those young days, and, you know, around that time, actually about 16, by 16 years old, I'd been in and out of custody a few times, nothing very long, you know. I had started hitchhiking around the country. We did that then. And, you know, adventurers, you know, swashbucklers, that sort of thing. And, you know, going in free spirits. And I hitchhiked all over the country, went to the Mardi Gras a few times. It was like a Mecca, you know, for my culture. Down in New Orleans, you go down there. And I crossed the country a few times. I had a great time. Or at least an interesting time and a free time. I still didn't quite have a handle on alcohol and drugs. I kind of sorted out the alcohol and drugs. I had every drug that there was. I shot heroin when I was 16. I took hundreds of doses of LSD and smoked pot every day and all that. But by the time I was 16 or so, it had pretty much settled in, 17, to alcohol was my drug of choice, right? And when I got to AA, at 24, I had long hair then and all, and some guy who was in NA too took me to an NA meeting, and he said, you know, you probably want to go to an NA meeting. And I went there, and I figured out from listening in that NA meeting that I wasn't an addict. You know, I'd taken every drug, and some drugs I liked as well as alcohol, but drugs I could sort of save some for later, you know. I could hoard them, you know, I could pour them out and fondle them. I like barbiturates, you know. In the end, I had a pretty bad barbiturate and alcohol habit, which is what kills people dead, you know. I mean, that was Jimi Hendrix and a bunch of people I knew. That was the thing. I was having a good time, but people were starting to die, you know, I wasn't the only one who was committed to drinking as a lifestyle and a culture. They started going, you know. 17, 18, 19, people were dying, you know. And they were sort of dramatic deaths at first, you know, like suicide by butcher knife and suicide by hanging and getting shot by the police, had a couple of those, and car wrecks and a lot of overdoses, right? And then it started to just be sort of liver failure. You know, I know 25 people who drank like I did in the teen and early 20s, and they all died. But the last 10 or 12 or so were just liver failure, you know. So these were the people, a lot of them, that in my heyday, they said, if I ever get that bad, I'll stop, you know. And there were people I said, if I ever get that bad, I'll stop. And those people were dead. You know, there was nobody like that anymore. I was the one, you know, the last one on the conveyor belt going over. And then I was able to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why I'm alive today. There's 25 dead ones who are alcoholics like me, and there's one sober one other than me, and he's a sponsee of mine. He's been sober for 39 years. And that's it, you know. So that thing about if you're young, it's a killer disease, incurable and fatal. That doesn't mean you're going to die tomorrow. It might, though. It might. But it means that you're going to have a short and sad life, you know. Even the ones who live to be in their 50s, friends of mine, weren't doing so hot in their last few years, right? It was pretty miserable. It's not a good way to go out, that liver failure thing. Not too dramatic sounding, but pretty bad, you know. So where I was in the end, I mean, I did the years of swashbuckling around, but somehow between, I don't know when it happened, but I went from being a swashbuckling adventurer free spirit to being a sort of bum, you know. I mean, you know, you start hitchhiking when people get sick of you, you know. And you go somewhere else in another town, and let's party, and pretty soon they're sick of you, so you move on. And I don't know how that happened. You know, I ended up at 20 years old in the free clinic in Dayton, Ohio. I was passing through sort of from the Mardi Gras to New York, and a friend of mine lived there. And I ended up on my 20th birthday in the free clinic, and I had an abscess on my arm about the size of an apple, and I weighed about 120 pounds, you know, I'm 160 something now. And I had on a pair of pants that somebody had given me after I got out of jail in Lafayette, Louisiana, that hit me about mid-calf. That was before that style became popular, you know. It's kind of the way to go now, but it wasn't then. And some sort of plastic beetle boot sort of thing, and some kind of raggedy shirt, and I've been wearing these clothes for a long time, and I was in the free clinic, and I'm waiting there to see the free clinic doctor, and there's this little a volunteer high school girl or college, or she had a little cross, and she looked really sweet, and she was giving me that look, you know. And I'm thinking, you know, look, I may not have much of an education, but I'm pretty well-read, you know. I'm pretty self-educated, and, you know, I've read a lot of philosophy and, you know, psychology, and, you know, I'm a swashbuckler and adventurer and a man about town, and, you know. But what I said to her was, "What are you looking at?" And she was startled like that, and the doctor took me in, and he looked at me and just give me one of those, and he took out a scalpel and he slashed that abscess, and you know, and you know, get out of here. Is there anything I should do? Just, you know, it was like that. And I had that a few times where I would go into the hospital with my head cut open and go in, and you know, they'd just lay me down and stitch it up and talk about how stupid, you know, how obnoxious I looked, and I'd say, "Do I need to pay or anything?" Get out, you know. And just that look, somewhere around 20 years old, I started getting that look more and more, you know. Police would stop me and say, "You've been on quite a drunk, haven't you?" And it wasn't like, "Wow, I admire you for being such an adventurer and a swashbuckler." It was, "You are a pathetic wino." And I was 20 years old, you know, and I actually was living. I got on this deal where you get 6 months paid training if you're completely unemployable. to learn how to be a landscaper. And so I was on that, but then that ran out, and I didn't get any job as no landscaper. So I was going to casual labor, you know. The thing was, I couldn't swashbuckle. I lost my snap. I couldn't steal. I'd had a girlfriend who stole from me. She was right out of the nut house, you know. That was the kind that sort of were attracted to me. And she would steal and panhandle, but she went back to Louisiana, where she was from. And I couldn't do any of that. I couldn't even beg. You know, I was just, I'd lost it. I'd lost my snap. And so there I was, and I was working casual labor, you know, the weed whip, you know, and whatever, you know, moving furniture and digging stuff. And I was a pathetic wino, you know, just out of my teens. And I decided that this had to stop, you know. At that point, I wasn't really having much fun drinking. And nobody really wanted to party with me. And I had friends, but they didn't like me, you know. And I decided to pull myself up by the bootstraps. This is for those of you who feel maybe you can pull yourself up by the bootstraps and knock off the stupid AA stuff. So I went with my certificate from the landscaping school, and I got a job for $2 an hour. And I was the only one on the crew who spoke English, but I went to work, you know. And then I heard they had jobs for the LA City Schools, and I went there. And I was pretty good at taking tests, you know. I'd always been a reader, even though I didn't go to school. So I took the test, and I did all right, and they sent me down to Watts on the crew down there, and they doubled my pay to $4 an hour, and I had it going on, right? And all I had to do was just not step out of line too far, you know. I wasn't going to quit drinking, you know. This was what this was all about, was so I'd have some drinking money, you know. I had to drink. You know, even though I wasn't having any fun, it was like it'd be really bad if I didn't drink. You know, there were hells below hells, you know, if I didn't drink. So I got that job, and I, you know, I did it. I got my driver's license back. I'd lost that a while back, and I got a vehicle, you know, some old beat-up thing, and I even got a girlfriend. You know, I'd kind of slipped below the level where you can get a girlfriend, you know. It's like you got nothing going for you, pal, you know, and it don't look so good either. So, but I got another crazy girlfriend, you know. She took about 20 volumes a day, and she was a pretty calm girl. And, you know. And I did it. I did it. I pulled myself up by my bootstraps, and I was doing as well as any of those people who didn't like me, those friends who didn't like me. I showed them, and I was never more miserable in my life. I hated it. I couldn't get enough to drink. You can't, you got to go to work on Mondays if you want to keep that job. You got to go work on Fridays because alcoholics take off on Fridays. And I just hated it, you know. And those three-day weekends were really bad. It was so much harder to go back on Tuesday. And the four-day weekend was murder, you know. I mean, what happened? I would just drink when I wasn't working, you know. I was still drinking, but I was not getting enough because you had to take that time off to be in the workday, you know. So I was never more miserable in my life, and one day I actually stayed in the job long enough to get a vacation, went on a vacation and just drank and took barbiturates and whatnot for 2 weeks and came back and I couldn't get to work. I just couldn't do it. I failed, you know. So I faked an accident, and while they were running through that paperwork, the girlfriend left and she took everything, you know. It was all hers, but, you know. There I was, and I said, I've got to quit drinking. I've got to. You know, this is it. I'm not having any fun. I had this, you know, I had a moment of clarity. This is bullshit. I can't do this anymore. I'm done. I don't care what anybody thinks. And I quit, and I detoxed myself. And I, you know, 4 days, no sleep, DTs, all that. But I did it, and then I drank again. And I was shocked. You know, what the hell did I do that for? And I quit again. And I drank again. And I quit again. And that went on and on and on. And I just knew, you know, they were running out. They were going to fire me. And I was going to go back to the streets, you know. Back to casual labor. Probably wouldn't be able to make that, you know. And more of these friends were dying. And I had one friend who we'd been friends since 14. born the same day. We went through everything together. He was doing fine, you know. Didn't get it, you know. He was, he was at the height of the culture there. He was, you know, selling drugs, and he had getting two sets of food stamps, and he was making porno movies, and the girls were coming, the prostitutes were coming over to buy drugs from him. You know, where did I go wrong? You know? But whatever, you know, he supported me. All those people who had been my friends were all for it. I quit drinking. Good! You know, they were still going, but they were glad that I was. But I couldn't stay. And so that's what got me to AA. I called once and was too shaky to even listen. And it's called Central Office. Some old guy was saying, well, let's see now. I think we got a beginner's meeting tonight. So I just showed up at AA. What saved my life was another drinking friend who's dead now. He took me once about 3 years before when I was about 21 or so. And he said, hey, you want to go laugh at the drunks? I said, what? And he said, I got this court thing I got to sign. Now, in those days, about 1 in 20 judges gave out court cards. I happen to have a friend that got one. So he knew where the AA place was. He took me there to laugh at the drunks. We were drunk, you know. And guys coming up, how you doing, brother? I got 90 days today. And I'm thinking, what a loser, you know. If I wanted to quit drinking, I'd quit drinking. I don't need to, you know, 90. So, but when I was desperate and really knew that I was going down, I was going to be dead or worse, you know. I'd gotten to the point where I was really thinking about suicide a lot and thinking, if I can just cheer up a little, I'm going to commit suicide. That's all. You know, get a little more psychic energy. So I went to an AA meeting. You know, I just went to that club. Luckily, that club moved around a lot. If they had moved, I don't know, I'd be dead probably. But they were there. I went in. I just sat there. I opened the book. You know, at random, I actually got there early. I didn't even know what time the meeting started. And it said, I opened to a vision for you. And it said, subjects of King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm, the vapor that his loneliness settled in. And it sounds kind of dramatic and old-fashioned, but I thought, yeah, that's me, you know. And I didn't know what was going on. I didn't believe in God. They said this prayer after it, and I just probably saved my life too. I said, just let them say the prayer. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to say anything. You don't have to stand there like this. You don't have to walk out in a huff. Just let them say their prayer. And I did. And that was sort of the way it went. I was willing to try some stuff that were so, so uncool and so stupid that I could not have possibly done it before that night I came in after I drank again, you know, for the many time. And I noticed I didn't want to drink after that meeting. I went home and went to bed. And then, so I went to another one, and I didn't want to drink after that meeting. And I got to the weekend. I made it through the weekend. I bought a big book. I read it all. I was a reader, you know. I read the whole thing. I got about 2% of it, you know. But the 2% sounded really good. And I just thought, you know, I kept waiting for the shoe to drop. I kept waiting to get drunk, you know, because I always did. I mean, there was no question that I wanted to stop drinking, but I couldn't do it. But I didn't do it as long as I was going to AA, and I decided to go for it at some point, you know, sort of like I decided to go for the alcohol thing, and I did the best I could, you know. I got a sponsor. I got the sponsor who was this sort of flamboyant character who, you know, got thrown out of the meeting a little later for pulling a knife on somebody, but he was good. It's cunning, baffling, and powerful. He drilled that in my head. Yes, you're right. You will drink again, left to your own devices. And he did a lot of inventories, you know. And so I did that. I actually did the steps. I did a crummy job, okay? I really did. I didn't do a very good job on the fourth step. Kind of balked on the fifth step. Had to go back to him and say, I left some out. The eighth step, I had no consultation at all with my sponsor. So I didn't put down, you know, half the names I should have, and put down a bunch that I didn't need to. I really recommend that you see your sponsor for all these things, right? You see somebody who's done it before. I was just too stupid, I guess. And he was busy with those guys that found behind the dumpster at the club. You know, I seemed to be doing better, so he left me to my own devices. So, but I got through enough. I did the steps well enough that I got a little traction, you know. I was able to stay sober until I could do them better, right? And I didn't believe in God. I didn't believe in any of that. But it says in the book, you know, if you're even willing to believe there could be a higher power, we emphatically assure you you're on your way. So I said, okay, I'm willing to believe in anything. You know, the Easter Bunny, whatever. I just don't want to drink anymore. And I held that thought. That's what AA does for you. It helps you to hold that thought. You hear people, you know. I hear people all the time that are smarter and more spiritual than me who got drunk because they didn't hold that thought. You know, I'm an alcoholic. I'm different. I drink different from other people. And left to my own devices, I will drink again. So I did that right, you know. And I stuck around, and I got a month, and I got a year, and got a sponsee, and you know, I made an effort to do the 11th step. You know, I read the books, and this ain't gonna work, but I'm willing. You know, that's it. It's the action, you know, that keeps you sober. It's not the intentions, any of that. It's doing the stuff they tell you to do that sounds stupid, that will get you sober. If you're willing to do that, and you actually do it, then you can stay sober, you know, is what I found out. You know, there's a difference, though, between saying, well, that's a great idea. Yes, those steps are a wonderful thing. Yes. And doing it. Yes, I need to get to more meetings. Yeah, I should start doing that. Yeah, go to more meetings. Do another image. There's a difference between figuring that and actually going to more meetings, right? So things happen. You know, I got one of those lives that I used to hate to hear about. You know, people would say, yes, I got sober a few years ago and I was washing dogs for $1 a dog and now I have my own real estate business. Or, you know, I was on the street in Skid Row and now I have a lunch card. Or I went back to school and became a teacher. And I knew that wasn't going to happen to me, you know, because I had been there. I'd been around for like 3 months and none of that stuff had happened. You know? So. But if you persevere, you know, if you keep cutting yourself off at the knees, things happen, you know. I moved and from I got away. I kept that gardening job, but I quit and I went on and got in a situation where I could go to school again. You know, I thought, well, I'll run this out. I can always go back to mowing lawns. And school worked okay for me. I always liked to read, you know. And I moved up to Northern California. I met Judy, my wife, there. She was in AA. I had 5 years. She had 3 years. We met on a blind date at a AA meeting. And we the next night we went to the big dance, the big AA dance. And, you know, somewhere in the middle of that, she said, let's go home right after the raffle. And we've been together ever since. That's be 36 years this at the end June 30th. And you know, I went back to school. I had to go to junior college, and because I hadn't, you know, had any credits or anything. But then I transferred, and I liked writing and reading, and I did okay, you know. And then I got a, I hate these stories when people tell me, but I went to grad school, you know, I went to this nice, good grad school in the Midwest for writers, and then I thought, well, there wasn't any job after that, you know, usually you get a teaching job or you write a best-selling novel. I didn't do either of those, but I could go to a PhD program. I thought, well, I'll just play this out, and I can always go back to mowing lawns, you know. But I went there all the time. I'm going to AA, and I was going to jail meetings, you know, because I used to go to jail fairly often, you know. Not for a long time, but, you know, juvenile hall, then jail. So something about going to jail and being able to get out again was good, you know. So I did service work, and I went to meetings, and I sponsored people, and I did okay. I got the PhD, and I got a job teaching in college, you know. I was a high school dropout. I'm teaching in college. I hate these stories, right? you know, had two beautiful kids that we just sent our son off with a grandchild, and my daughter was over. They both like me. They both love us, you know. You know, it's just, it's been a really good life, thanks to AA, you know. Thanks to AA, I did get a life. And, you know, I went through all kinds of stuff. You know, when you get to 7 years or so, you get, you know, you're going back to school, you got a job, you got a relationship, and you, you know, you kind of cut back on your meetings, you know, because, you know, you got to live life. You hear people in meetings say this, you know, I don't want to just have my whole life be AA. Life is for living. I've got to get out there. And that's true as long as you stick close to AA. If you're my kind of alcoholic, you know, which I'm just sort of the average kind of alcoholic, so you probably are. you kind of got to stick close, you know. Especially, I mean, I came in young and I wasn't here early, you know. If you're here young, you're not here early. If you've gotten in this much trouble to get you to AA, you know, you aren't going to make it to 30 or 40 or 50, probably. You know, it isn't going to happen. It wasn't going to happen for me. You know, my trajectory was about, you know, 25 or 26, unless I went to prison, which can keep you, you know, alive for a while. But basically, I was just, you know, dying to commit suicide. So I'd probably gone that way or killed somebody or whatever. But, you know, certainly I was, you know, they started dying. All those people said, if I ever get that bad, I'll quit. Started dying. That friend of mine who was doing so well, you know, my brother there, he made it till I was 7 years sober. He was doing great. He was now selling massive quantities of cocaine and, you know, had even more prostitutes hanging around his house. And then one day he just died. You know, he was drinking, his liver was bad, and he just blew his heart out with cocaine and heroin probably. And so it went, you know. But I was doing okay. I went to a lot of funerals. You know, I've been to a lot of funerals. And, you know, it's AA, and it's God. I hate to say this, folks, but I used to hate that, too. I'd be going, I can kind of relate to this guy. But then they'd say something about God, and, you know, oh, well. but here's the good news. You don't have to, like, tackle God, you know, run him down and tackle God, kind of just grew on me. One day I just realized, I'd been reading the books, and I said, whatever prayer you want to say, and I read, you know, and I said prayer, ask God to keep me sober. Some guy early on said, am I down to 1 minute now? Are we there? No, oh, my goodness.
About 10.
Okay, good. Phew. I saw the 1 minute sign. So some guy said, well, here's what you do. You ask God to keep you sober in the morning and you thank him at night. And I said, I don't believe in God. I can't do that. He said, well, just do it. And I said, I can't do it. I don't believe in God. And he said, what do you got to lose, pal? And that was a revelation. That probably saved my life too. So, all right. You know, whatever, you know, Tooth Fairy, Santa Claus, God, keep me sober, I'll take it. And I thanked him at night, because every night really was kind of a special deal. I didn't get drunk today, you know, because I had drank daily pretty much from 15, you know, some kind of drug. And it was a miracle, really, to me. And I thought, something's going on here. I'm not doing this. I mean, I wanted to stay sober before, and I did it. You know, and I didn't do it. I couldn't stay sober, and I'm staying sober somehow. You know, months are passing, and so there's something going on. And I figured out, if you're having trouble with God, you know, I figured out maybe it's me. You know, maybe these people aren't all crazy. Maybe they have a better receptor than I do. You know, they're hooked up to the Time Warner cable, and I've got the rabbit ears. You know. And I live in, I got AT&T. You know, I'm out in Julian with the rabbit ears or something. And so, you know, I kept an open mind. All right, if there's a God, that's fine. You know, I actually had a spiritual experience early on, which I discounted completely. I took my first guy home from a meeting. He needed a ride. I was a couple months sober, and I took him there, and I talked to him about being sober. And I got in my car, and I had this feeling that, gee, everything's going to be all right. Everything is working out just the way it's supposed to. I'd never had anything like that in my life, you know. I had that feeling. And I thought, huh, acid flashback, I guess. I don't know. So I went for years before I remember that. You know, I actually had spiritual experiences early on, but you don't, they're subtle, you know. They're not, you know, Jesus coming down and saying, here I am. But over time, I came to believe at first that there was something that was keeping me sober and would continue to keep me sober as long as I kept doing this thing. And I had that period at 7 years. I think I started to talk about that. But, you know, you say, geez, you know, I got to live my life. But when I did that, I was busy. I had two kids, and I was in school. I was working a couple of jobs and not getting to many meetings, and I started to kind of go nuts, you know. Things bugged me a lot. I didn't feel right. And I thought, maybe I need to go to more meetings. And I asked some old guy, I think maybe I need to go to more meetings. How many meetings are you getting to? Well, I don't know, every 10 days or so. So why don't you try going to more meetings? And I thought, yes, yes, the oracle. And then at 20 years sober, I was going, you know, I was going to 2-3 meetings a week. I was sponsoring people. I was going to jail. But at 20 years sober, I hit this depression, you know. I just moved out here. My new boss, PhD in psychology from Harvard, said, I was here on the job for a couple of days, and she said, out of nowhere, we're in the workroom, and she said, my brother's name was Rick. He tortured me all through my childhood. And I thought, well, so much for this job. You know, I mean, I moved all the way out here. I gave up the tenure. You know, I became a professor with the PhD. You know, it was either, you know, should I take some antidepressants? Everybody's taking antidepressants. Maybe I should get some. And I thought, well, something told me, why don't you try going to 90 meetings in 90 days first? You've been here for 22 years, and you never tried that. And so I tried that. That was back in 2001, and I've been averaging about 1+8 meetings a week from that time. And I tell you what, I feel a lot better than I did. A lot of that stress went way down, and I noticed that. If I'm close to AA, you know, it doesn't matter how many years you got, folks. If you're feeling a little antsy and a little off, a little restless, irritable, discontent, try going, you know, if you can't do 90 and 90, try 30 and 30. See what happens. Try 7 and 7 and see what happens, right? I'd never tried that in all my years. It works, you know. And somehow there's that fellowship. I need to be with other alcoholics, like daily. You know, I need to make some contact. I hate to admit it, you know, but that's the way it is for me. I should be more spiritual, more enlightened by now with 41 years sober, but I need to be with other alcoholics. I need to hear this. My brain tells me I don't have this, you know. At 20-some years sober, I picked up a book. It was a big book that they gave me when I moved from Iowa City after I got my master's degree. There's about 9 names in there. Guys signed it, you know, and 6 of those people were drunk. It had been a few years. 6 of them had gone back to drinking. So my brain, I hadn't been going to too many meetings about that time. My brain went something like this in about 3/4 of a second. It went, huh, those guys got drunk. They must be real alcoholics. I didn't get drunk. Therefore, I must not be a real alcoholic. Therefore, I can drink again. That's it, you know, that was it. 12 years sober or something, you know. So I'm, you know, I still got it. I still got it. I'm still prone to resentments, you know. It's like, you know, a magnet, you know, dust magnet or something. I'm still prone to self-pity and weird perceptions, not seeing things as they are, right? I'm still prone to all that alcoholic stuff. Even though I asked God to help me with that, you know. But through prayer, going to a meeting usually breaks that spell, you know. Going to the jail meetings really helps. Get a service commitment if you're feeling a little antsy. You know, I go to the jail meeting and I'm feeling kind of, angsty. I go in there and I hear some people who have real problems, you know. And I go out of there, I'm so happy, you know. I'm so happy to be getting out of there. and that I found AA, you know. All those cliches that you hear in AA, just stick around, you know. They'll all come true, including the good ones about having a good life. Including the ones about feeling comfortable in your own skin. Including wanting to be of service to others. And some freedom from the bondage of self. I say that prayer every morning, you know, the third step prayer. And I say it over. I say that part of it. Please relieve me of the bondage of self. Please relieve me of the bondage of self. Please relieve me of the bondage of self. That sounds like a good thing now, you know. Because the bondage of self is everything that's keeping me down, right? You know, and doing God's will is what's keeping me up. Now, if you catch me on a bad day, you know, don't hold me to any of this. I mean, I might say, that guy, Dr. Paul, who wrote Acceptance is the Answer, a Doctor Alcoholic Addict, I knew some guy called him, and he said, I've got a problem here. And the guy said, look, I'm busy, okay? Dr. Paul, you know, and he said, well, but you said that you wanted to help people, and you wrote that great story. And he said, look, I was having a good day then, okay? I'm not now. Click. Still a great, he's helped millions of people. So we're all alcoholics, right? We all have that alcoholic brain. I'm so glad I found this place and found you people. Thank you. Thank you for keeping me sober.